who's the best show here?
Head show! Head show! Head show! Yeah!
The Linux Link Tech Show is on.
Is on.
Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Episode 180. Here we are.
Dan didn't screw up the intro.
I told you I wasn't going
to. Congratulations, Dan.
You're welcome. Do something right. There's only two files on there now, so it's really hard to screw up.
Make things a little more easier for you.
That's it.
Well, we got a really great guest tonight. We've got JTS Moore, the director of Revolution OS. JTS, welcome to the Tech Show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's
our
pleasure.
You made a great movie. We're all big fans of it. We all went out and legally purchased it, right, Dan?
Well, I sincerely appreciate that tremendously.
We'll get into that
movie
in a little bit.
Yeah. It's a great movie. When exactly did Revolution OS come out, 2001?
It first screened in 2001 at Linux World in New York, and then screened in Linux World 2001 in San Francisco. And then it was released by an art house distributor, Seventh Art Releasing, in 2002. And then also in 2002, it premiered on the Sundance Channel. And then the DVD release came in 2003. So with the independent documentaries, it's a much more extended kind of release pattern than what you'd have with the big studio movie. So but it really, the focus of the film, you know, from my original conception was not so much kind of like a news story, like where is Linux and open source at this moment. It was to kind of capture the early history of it, because that's what attracted me. I'm not a techie per se. I'm not even a Linux user, but my background is in film. And so what really attracted me to doing a documentary about Linux and open source and free software was the story of its founding, the people behind it, and why they did it. And I thought that, well, long term, that'll be more interesting than if I like talked about, you know, what version of the kernel was out in 2001 or 2000, and, you know, who did which patches, and, you know, and the ins and outs of the GNU C compiler and things like that. But the thing that I thought would be more accessible, and quite frankly was successful to me, was the kind of the conception, starting with Richard Stallman, and then how the creation of Linux and the evolution that the whole movement took at that point, how that influenced things. And while I think for some people the difference between, say, free software and open source may seem like an arcane thing, it's really an interesting insight into the outlook of what this means, both, you know, economically and kind of politically. And those were kind of the ideas that attracted me and why people did this. And I think long term, you know, it's kind of like, you know, 20 years from now, you know, what may have happened in the year 2007 may or may not be interesting, but what will always be interesting is why did Linux and open source and free software ever come to be, and who were the people in the ideas that really kind of got it going? And that was always the approach of the documentary. It's interesting to kind of look back on the film now, because now it's been essentially 5-6 years since it started to circulate, you know, and it definitely is history now. At least I think of it that way, and it's just kind of interesting to see how things have changed and how the perception of the film kind of evolves.
So by your own admission, you don't use Linux, and it's usually rather odd for somebody who doesn't use Linux or involved in the community to hear about it. How did you get attracted to it to begin with, or to the concept of free software and open source software?
Well, I've used Apple computer products my entire life. The first computer I ever touched was an Apple IIe. And then in the late 80s, when I went to college, my first computer I had in college was the original Macintosh. And so I'm a diehard Mac loyalist. So in one sense, I can appreciate where the GNU and Linux people are coming from, because, you know, I've got more brand loyalty than Apple than anything else in the world. And, you know, and particularly through the 90s especially, you know, it was a rough going being an Apple advocate. But the way I got hooked in was I actually had a buddy of mine from undergrad, from Stanford, that had gone to work in Linux startups. And one day I just called him up to chat, just, you know, touch base, and he said, "You ought to make a movie about Linux." And my first thought was, that is really an obscure, dry idea. This was 99. And I had just heard a smidgen about Linux. I think I'd read a little article in Time magazine earlier in the year, and I'd heard my friends mention they were doing something with Linux, and it was like some sort of computer system thing. And I knew nothing. And just to back up a second, after I went to Stanford, I went to USC Film School and studied filmmaking and directing. So that's the reason he would mention that to me. And initially I was like, that's an odd suggestion. But rather than just kind of shoot it down, I thought, wait, what would the story be? And that was my question. And then he started telling me about, you know, this guy, Linus Torvalds, who had kind of created this, and there's a whole movement had grown around it, and, you know, it was kind of the little guy versus Microsoft, and it was all about freedom and all these startups. And I thought, okay, maybe there's something here. And so I started to research it, and what I found was there was almost nothing on it. There were a few articles here and there, you know, things that people had posted or written, like Eric Raymond, Cathedral and the Bazaar, a few little scattered news stories, but there was no kind of overarching history or description of the movement that had really entered the mainstream press. And so the neat thing was, well, this is something people haven't really been over already. And maybe it's not just yet another little variation on the kind of the late 1990s Silicon Valley tech bubble theme that was kind of percolating around. I thought, okay. So then I made a research trip up to Silicon Valley, and I had another buddy of mine named Neil Carellin. He picked me up, and basically we spent a couple of days going around Silicon Valley, you know, going to a big Exodus facility down in Sunnyvale, and kind of seeing a big co-location facility. And kind of at the time he worked for, Abracadabra or something like that, that then became GoTo, and then eventually he went to Google. And so I'm sure things have worked out quite well for him. But he also, because he was really well versed in the history of Linux because he'd been involved with it since the early 90s at Stanford, you know, who's able to give me a really good overview. And what was really interesting was what I discovered: it wasn't just about Linus Torvalds and open source and Linux. There was a bigger story there, which was Richard Stallman and free software, and then kind of seeing how all that fit together, that really got interesting. And so with that in mind, then I started to move forward, and kind of the beginning of the whole production was actually Linux World 1999, right when, and it was that Linux World when Red Hat went public. The other Linux companies were kind of on the bubble, about to go out, and, you know, that was right, you know, at the time where kind of the exuberance in Silicon Valley was getting close to the peak, and it was incredible energy. And coincidentally, you had Richard Stallman and Linus Torvalds sharing the stage for the same time, at the same time, which at the time I didn't really realize what I was capturing. I just knew there was something interesting there. And so that was how it started. And then from there, I basically would talk to people, ask, well, who should I talk to? And then I'd go interview this person. And I'd use the interviews as kind of first-person primary source research to kind of construct the story. And then just kind of pieced it all together from there. So it was really, I kind of had to research it. There was no kind of roadmap on what is the history of free software and software and open source at the time. So obviously you might not get everything everyone wants in there. You know, I look back and there might have been one or two things here, one or two people I'd like to talk to. But I feel like you get the broad stroke of what it is. And so and I think that's the key thing, to really kind of get, you know, make sure you've got, you know, the main points down and the main kind of sequence of events as it happened, have those down. So
how approachable were the individuals that you interviewed for the movie? I mean, were they very excited to do this, or Maybe not so excited.
The answer is it depended upon the person and their schedule. One of the tricky things was that most of the people, even though the film is somewhat Silicon Valley focused, due to kind of reasons of geography being close to Los Angeles, and that's where a lot of these companies were, a lot of the key people aren't in Silicon Valley necessarily, but what is convenient is, especially at that time, people would cross paths in Silicon Valley all the time. So the trick was trying to find myself in the same place and time without having to fly all around the country hunting everyone down. So the two trickiest people are the stars of the film, Linda Stavros and Richard Stallman. Stallman I approached at Linux World 1999, and he was very standoffish. And it's a good thing I didn't do the interview there anyhow, because it wasn't a good, quiet environment, so on and so forth. But he was very standoffish. And it took me a couple of months of just continually exchanging emails and whatnot to get him to agree to an interview. And then finally he agreed, and I drove up to San Francisco and did an interview at a coffee house. It was an internet coffee house called CoffeeNet, south of Market there in San Francisco. It was a great
Now, did Richard Stallman require the case of brown M&Ms like he has when he's come on our show?
No, he didn't require that. Did not require that. It was more about trying to it was tough because you don't want to give away your editorial independence, but his concern was that he was somehow going to be marginalized vis-a-vis Linus. And free software would be marginalized vis-a-vis open source. And there was no way to, there's no way to kind of guarantee what the edit of the film is going to be going in. But I think what I had to convince him was that I had an open mind, that I wasn't coming in with a built-in bias, and I was willing to hear what he had to say. And I had a great interview, and I'm so glad, because, for me, that is the key film. I think Revolution OS, without Richard, without RMS, would be an incomplete film, as it would be if you didn't have Linus in there. And that, again, then getting Linus was very tricky. Basically, I mean, that's the star, that's the guy you want to get. But Linus, has, at the time he was getting a tremendous amount of attention in terms of the press, and so he didn't need to go out of his way to talk to the press, and so consequently, someone that was kind of an unknown, there was no reason for him to talk to me. But fortunately, Larry Augustin at VA Linux was a buddy of his, and Larry's, as you know, in the documentary. And so finally, and Larry's wife, Alice, was really close with Linus's wife. And at the time, Linus lived in a little duplex in Cupertino. And so while we're up in Silicon Valley, actually, I was scheduled to go to the Bay Area Linux users Chinese dinner in Chinatown that night, and on less than 24 hours notice I get a call saying Linus has agreed to sit for an interview, can you be there tomorrow night at like 5 o'clock or 4:30 or something. I was like, okay, because I didn't think, I don't know, I'll get another shot. So it was like I dropped everything, that's where we went. Once we got there, he was fantastic. I mean, we were at his tiny little duplex for way longer than we intended, but he was such a sport and we got such great footage. It was just great, but it's one of those things that, it took a little bit of luck and a little help from some friends to make it happen. But I'm so glad it did. He was such a great sport, and kind of captured what I think was really interesting about the film also is capturing everyone at that point in time. Right as kind of Linux was breaking out into the public consciousness, so it was before everyone had gotten kind of, I don't want to say professionalized, but it had gotten, really adept in doing all the media. Where, so I feel like you got people maybe a little closer to who they are versus, 5 years later, if you've done 500 interviews, you're going to be a little more practiced in your approach. But if it's like, early on, you're not going to be as self-conscious about what you're doing. It's maybe a little less about getting the specific points of the message. And if you can get an interview, you can meet the person. That's what I thought was interesting, because all these guys, and they are all men in the movie. I think there's like two women in the background the whole movie. It's kind of like Lawrence of Arabia. But all these guys, are really interesting personalities. Like Bruce Perens, at the time, I didn't know when I interviewed him what he'd be like, but he's a really neat guy. Just to talk to him and kind of that optimism and enthusiasm was fascinating. So that was kind of the process, and then it was constantly trying to track, figure out when I could be in some place where one of the other interview subjects was going to be, and trying to make so it took a while to make the film. I mean, I guess if you're like a big TV network with all, you can fly all the country, all the resources, you can probably knock something out like this fairly quickly. Also, I guess if CNN and college are much more likely to get people just to agree to do something. But, it took time. You'd have to persuade someone. I'd say, well, I just interviewed Bruce Perens, and I talked to so-and-so. I said, Brian Bellendorf, would you like to sit for an interview? And then I tell them who I interviewed. And then they kind of, if they don't know who you are, then they kind of go by, well, who have you interviewed? And that gives you a sense of, well, how legitimate this thing is. Because I know at the time I started the documentary, I think there were a couple of, there must have been at least a couple other indie documentaries going, trying to make something about Linux. But, it's easy to start kind of a project. The challenge is to see it all the way through and finish it, because it just takes a lot of time. Even if you're using a little digital video camera, it still takes financial resources if you're going to actually go track all these people down and finish the project, edit it all together, mix the sound, have music, license the photos and all this stuff. So, that's the thing, kind of convincing people it's worth their while to give you a couple hours of their time.
Well, doing the show, like, I send out usually emails to all the different people in the community, and for the most part, the people are pretty approachable. You just have to ask nicely. And for the most part, most people are willing to come on and talk about whatever topic you want to talk about.
When you have to conduct these type of interviews, when you were doing Revolution OS, I take it that you had to do this all on your own tab there. All came out of your pocket and your love for the work.
On my credit card, my checking account, yeah.
That's a pretty big endeavor. And, did you have to fly all over the country, or did you just, like you said, primarily stay in Silicon Valley?
I tried to primarily work out of Silicon Valley, because luckily, like I said, most everyone, let me rephrase that, everyone at some point would come through, of the people with them, they all at some point would come through Silicon Valley. So I was able to work that as my base. And so that way, I could go up there and I'd be like, okay, I'm going to do an interview with Brian Bellendorf, and I also need to go out and shoot B-roll, just visuals of stuff. And so you could economize that way. So, yeah, I couldn't have done it if it involved me literally flying all over the country tracking people down. So yeah, because I'd load up a van and myself and my camera assistant would drive up there. So, which is a lot cheaper than, once you involve all, it's one thing to fly yourself someplace, but once you've got all the equipment cases and whatnot, then it rapidly escalates in cost. And again, like if you're a big TV network, I guess that's just part of the business and you've got the budget for it. But, an indie person, it's a bigger chunk of change.
So you do all this work, you get all these interviews, you finally put this product together, and you decided to release it without any copy protection on it. What made you decide that?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a couple of things. First of all, I feel, we might get into the subject a little bit later on. I feel very strongly about intellectual property. I can respect Richard Stallman's kind of concept and approach to intellectual property, but I don't agree. For my purposes, that doesn't work. I'm a very strong believer in intellectual property. Likewise, though, I understand you have to have a you have to have fair use, and that's the one thing. We have this weird, we've gone in this weird direction where people simultaneously, individuals don't really respect intellectual property as much. At the same time, corporations, really abuse and limit the concept of free fair use. So with that spirit, I thought, it's like, I didn't like the idea that I would sell you a DVD and then I would somehow limit your personal use of the DVD. Now, part of that is a trust in the people you're selling the DVD to, that they won't abuse the fact that you've trusted them and you've not encrypted, the data. And likewise, the thing with the region, having regional encoding, I didn't see why should I, once the thing's out there on DVD, if someone from overseas wants to buy it or in a different region, I didn't see why I should basically interfere with their ability to use their DVD player and their DVD. So it was somewhat a nod to the spirit of what, you know, of what open source and free software is. While at the same time, I thought, you know, not, you know, at least, you know, intellectually undercutting the idea of intellectual property. That said, the challenge for me has been, you know, obviously the movie's been heavily pirated, and that's a very unfortunate thing for me, you know, and you know, so that's kind of how it goes.
How long did it actually take you to do all the interviews and all the filming and get all the content together?
I was basically in production the time I first, I don't know, it was about just under, it's about 20 months. You know, from the time I first started researching the project, the time that, you know, I was screening a finished film print of it. And that's the other thing to keep in mind. So Revolution OS actually was shot and finished on film. And more specifically, 35mm film and in CinemaScope, so, which is an extraordinarily unusual thing. But that's kind of a reflection of, you know, my film school background, the fact I actually love shooting film. And then also kind of the idea was that if this really is, you know, something of note historically, you know, what's going on with free software and open source, well, then you want to put it on the best archival medium possible, and that's still 35mm film, so...
That must have been a lot of work then, cutting it by hand.
Yeah. Well, film. What you do now is you shoot on film, you transfer to video for editing, and then from the video editing on an Avid or on Final Cut Pro, you, because there's all the footage is coded, you get a shot, you get an edit list, and you take the edit list and the raw negative to Negative Cutter, and then they will literally go into that negative and cut it apart and splice it together, and then you take that cut negative to the lab, and the lab makes the film print. You know, what's happening on most big studio films now is that they do a digital intermediate, so basically they'll do what I've just described, but rather than simply cut the negative and go to the film lab, they'll scan the negative now at 4K resolution, and then make all their image corrections to the digital files of the scanned image, and then output it back, hopefully, you know, on a laser scanner or something at 4K resolution. So that's another step. You know, that's still a very expensive step for an independent, and that wasn't really, I just started. I think A Brother Where Out, that was the first film to do that, and I think that came out in 2001. So that wasn't even, you know, a possibility if I'd wanted to spend the money. But so that's how the film business is evolving. In terms of, you know, I think film origination is here for a while longer, and film delivery is here for a while longer. It's in the middle where you're getting the digitization. So,
okay, Pat, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I just want to know. You went and showed the film at all the different film festivals. What was some of the response that you got from the non-tech, free software, open source people? Just, you know, moviegoers in general.
Well, you know, that's the delightful thing is that now granted, like, if you're going to, you know, yourself, you know, it's kind of a self-selecting process. In general, people that have no interest in technology are not going to go walk in a movie that the description is all about Linux. So that, you know, that helps a lot. But so for the people that were not techies that went and saw the film, it was great because they could get into it as a story, like I said, and a history of ideas. And one of the things I also did is, unlike, say, again, watching something on TV, you know, on TV news, say, watching something on Fox or MSNBC or CNN, where when they do their, quote, documentaries, it's very cutty, and you'll cut to the blonde news reporter doing the interview or whatnot. You know, I intentionally decided not to do that. I said, I'm shooting 35mm film. I'm going to be putting on a big screen. I'm going to have a high-resolution image. And I think all the people in the film, they're very distinct-looking. They have distinct personalities, and they're the stars of the movie. You know, I do not appear in the movie. You will hear my voice in the background for questions occasionally, but I am not a character in the movie. I'm not Michael Moore, so to speak. So I intentionally would hold longer on my subjects than what you'd see on TV. Because I wanted you to get that point where you felt like you were there with them and you could see them, not just hear the content coming out of their mouth. And that was the neat thing, is people would respond to that. I'd say, wow, I felt like I was, like Richard Stallman is across the table from me. I could kind of study him and see who he is. And so that was the neat thing, that when people who were not techies would get the film and be intrigued by the ideas and find the story interesting and get the jokes occasionally, you know, because it's not, you know, there's intentionally kind of humorous moments in the film that I just captured during the making of the film. But what I find ironic is I remember, which there was one review, I think it may have been the San Jose Mercury review, that chastised the film for being unintentionally funny. And at that point, it was already listed on the Internet Movie Database as a documentary / comedy. And I had to send the guy an email saying, you know that the laughs are in the movie, such as the Gnu Solomon singing the free software at the end, that's intended to be ironic. I mean, we're not, the people involved in the film are not that oblivious to their presentation. There's intentional humor in the movie. So and that was nice when people would pick up on all that.
Well, one of my favorite moments from the film was when you recorded the guys going to protest up in Redmond, Washington. I think
it was actually in Foster City to the Silicon Valley office for Microsoft at the time. I think that Microsoft's now moved down to Mountain View near where Google is. But at the time, they were up in Foster City, which is closer to the San Francisco airport, and they had an office tower there. And, yeah, for the Windows Refund Day protest.
And I don't think anybody was successful in getting that money.
No, I don't think so. But the change was they did have success, though, because now you don't have to buy a computer that comes preloaded with Windows or Vista now. And I think that's the larger point.
There's a lot of vendors nowadays where you can get Linux pre-installed, which is a great thing.
Exactly. And I think that was their larger point. It's like, you know, why give it? We don't, you know, they would say, we don't want to buy a computer with Windows on it. Can we just buy the hardware and load our stuff in? And the computer makers would say no. And that was kind of what got the whole ball rolling. But
So do you still keep up with what's going on in the free and open source communities?
Not a whole lot. It's I haven't been to Linux World Expo and conference in probably about 3 years. So I was actually going to ask y'all, because I know they just had Linux World up in New York City last week, if anyone attended and kind of what the feel was. I mean, one of the things, you know, one of the things I noticed the last few I went to, it was definitely, there was a huge transition going on. Those first few Linux Worlds, you know, 2000, 1999, even 2001, you still had that kind of wild and woolly, kind of all the independent, you know, companies and whatnot. And then, you know, after 2001, it started transition, and then it really became, you know, you got IBM, and Hewlett Packard, and Dell, and, you know, and it became much more mainstream, which is a tribute to the success of the open source movement, but also lost kind of that kind of kinetic energy that it had. And I'm just wondering, you know, if anyone had been to one of the recent Linux Worlds and if that was still the case or, if, you know, if it's continued to evolve.
You wouldn't be the only one who would notice that. yeah. We've noticed, too, that it's become a lot more corporate and a lot less community involvement in the Linux Worlds. And, in fact, if I'm not mistaken, this past Linux World, was it open to the public? Because I'm not up in New York, so I don't know. I was under the impression that
I think it was only paid. I think it was only a paid conference. You had to pay to attend.
It was really a paid
I think you're right. Yeah, and it was only a corporate kind of thing anyway. So
it was sessions that didn't have a show floor, if I'm not mistaken. Correct.
Oh, really? They got rid of the. I saw it was at Marriott Marquis, and I was just wondering if they finally, they no longer had the big.
From what I understand, they got rid of all their community support whatsoever.
Oh, really?
Which is, you know, pretty much why none of the community attended. So
what is the sense? Does it still have that? Does it still have, from your experience? I mean, you should know, especially since y'all have the weekly talk show. Does it still have that grassroots quality that made it such an amazing thing, say, 5-7 years ago? I mean, how is it? Because I guess that answers my question. I'm somewhat out of the loop on it as much just because I'm no longer doing, you know, I used to, you know, for a period of time, I would go to events, go to film festivals and screen the film and talk to a lot of people. But, you know, since I'm not a Linux open source advocate, you know, it wasn't my mission to constantly stay involved. And so I was just wondering if that grassroots quality that made it such a great thing, if that's evolved, is there still that is it still there? Is it just the corporate thing is what's more front and center, or do you think people's enthusiasm has declined?
It's definitely community still. What it is, in the very beginning, it was very grassroots, very community-oriented. It still pretty much is on a local level. The difference between then and now is that Linux is pretty much everywhere, especially in IT shops. So corporations have to be involved. They have to accept it. They have to go to these conferences. We were in the .org pavilion, which was a section of the Linux World Expo in Boston. We were there a couple of years ago. It was last year, actually, in Boston. We went to that. And it was a lot of fun. There was still a lot of community projects involved. But overall, the feel of the whole conference was very corporate. Now, there are other conferences that are going on besides Linux World, such as Ohio Linux Festival, the Scale Conference, which was a couple of weeks ago in Los Angeles, the Northwest Linux Conference. There's still plenty of smaller community conferences that are going on that still have that community feel to them. You know, the Linux World Expo is definitely more corporate.
I should have checked out the Scale thing. I didn't know about it since I'm here in L.A. And what about with the Lug? I mean, one of the things I really was impressed with was the vibrancy of the Lug community. And is that still there? Do people still go to the Lug meetings? Do the Install Fest? Is that still going like it was, again, you know, say 5-6 years ago?
I would say it's growing, that whole community.
I thought that was one of the really kind of compelling and neat things about open source, is that you had this grassroots support network. I mean, that was the key thing, you know, to convince people that there was something more out there than just doing kind of the Wintel monopoly.
Yeah, there's still a lot of Lugs, and I know that when I left the Lehigh Valley, the Lug up there was still... You guys were getting new members every month, weren't you? You still are, correct?
Yeah, there's always new faces every month.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things, again, is my tip of the hat to the open source community, you know, with my film, and I don't know if you know this or not, but any Lug or similar group that would ever ask to screen the DVD... always gave them permission because I wanted to use that as kind of encourage. All I asked is just they not use a pirated copy of the movie, just as a way to kind of encourage the Lugs and kind of share the film with people, you know, because, you know, they've been very helpful in making the movie.
Yeah, you know, and in conjunction with what you were saying there before about the whole community, I do think there is still a very, 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 very strong community surrounding open source and free software and Linux and the BSDs and everything. That still exists. In the past couple of years, you've had a lot more corporate participation and influence, and I think a lot of what goes on today is you've got the pendulum swinging really wildly between the two different camps, the extreme of the two different camps, and there is occasionally a lot of friction and collision that can occur, like the whole Novell incident of the past couple of months and how that's being treated, you know, what Novell and the corporate side believes as opposed to what the community believes, the direction Linux and free software
should
take.
What was the Novell situation?
I guess the biggest thing in a nutshell, if you didn't hear about it, was Novell formed a partnership with Microsoft, and out of this partnership, while the two companies will work on technology together, specifically interoperability between their products and virtualization capabilities on both, more on the Microsoft side. One of the other things that they came out was a patent deal that a covenant that Novell wouldn't sue Microsoft or Microsoft's customers, or Microsoft wouldn't sue Novell customers for any possible patent infringement their products may have. And this was not taken too lightly by the Linux community and the GNU community, who felt that this...
Why was that?
Well,
insinuation
Microsoft failed to incorporate open source software and then close it up? Is that the concern?
The insinuation is that Linux is stealing patents technology from Microsoft. That's the impression that people get. by going into bed with Microsoft, they're saying, okay, you know, Linux users have infringed against Microsoft patents. You know, we're looking beyond that now.
Uh-huh.
That's the impression a lot of people got out of it.
And you know, that impression that's the case was further the flames were further fueled by the fact that, you know, the day after, Steve Ballmer comes out and says Linux users have an open bill with Microsoft because they're infringing upon our patents. Therefore, you know, they need to come to the table and license these patents from us. And that was the whole Novell deal. Plus, on top of that, such an agreement whereby Novell would say, by the Novell agreement, you can run Novell's or OpenSUSE or Linux from Novell, violates or potentially could violate the GPL, in that now they have made something that you cannot pass on to everybody else.
Right,
like
right,
with,
right.
With the software, you can freely give it to everybody who wants a copy of it, but now you can't pass that same patent covenant on to anybody else. It's strictly for people who purchase it or license it from Novell. And that, while the agreement that was made does not violate the GPL, the letter of the GPL version 2, it does violate kind of the intent, is what a lot of people believe. And now they're trying to work towards, you know, putting a clause in the GPL version 3 that would prevent this type of behavior or action from happening again, these type of agreements.
Now, this sounds reminiscent of the Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz operating system, SCO, that situation from a couple of years ago, where they were claiming that Linux had been based upon some old Unix patents that had gotten incorporated in there. But that trial, that never came to trial, correct?
It's in trial now.
It's not in trial. What they're doing is they're going through with a judge, going line by line, and it seems that the case is just dying on the vine. You know, the whole thing with SCO was, you know, a lot of people got the impression that Microsoft was actually funding SCO, supposedly.
Well, because didn't they, like, buy their stock, and then Bill Gates is, like, venture capital company that he had money in, give money to them?
There was a third outside party company that was providing funding to SCO. I mean,
yeah.
SCO as a product is pretty much dead. You know, back in the day, SCO Unix was actually a very good product that I actually used. It was my first Unix. But it since then, it's pretty much a shell of itself. All they do is go around suing their own customers, basically.
Right.
And it's really on its last legs. You know?
But have they found, as they've been going looking for infringing code, have they really found anything? Because I thought that was the ultimate of the whole debate, is that there really wasn't.
Nope.
They were basically bluffing people, but no one could really, they would never release what they'd found.
Now, nothing's come to pass as of yet. If you go to Groklaw, which is a website that Pamela Jones maintains, she goes through, anytime they have hearings and discussions, she goes pretty much into detail about what's going on with the case. And she's even come under attack from the SCO people, claiming that she wasn't a real person, that she was just a front for IBM, you know, so that she could, you know, a mouthpiece, so to say, you know, to attack SCO. And it's totally ridiculous. She's a real person. I've actually, you know, exchanged emails with her, and people have actually met her in person. So, but the case is pretty much on its last legs. It's not going to go anywhere.
Hmm. And so, that's interesting that Novell would do that, because I understand that the can of worms that opens up by kind of tacitly conceding that there might be something if Microsoft. Right, you know, somewhere in the Linux code and then GPL issues. So where do you see kind of Linux going from here? I mean, do you see it changing its trajectory, or is it pretty much on the same trajectory, which is it becomes, you know, kind of just the kind of the standard operating system for, you know, kind of industrial applications, so to speak? I mean, where do you see it going?
Well, it's definitely one on the server. I mean, I think it's a very high number, the total new installs for servers. It's, I don't know, it's 40-50%, somewhere in that range. Right now, the big push is for the desktop. And
right.
Currently,
right.
You know, there's no real hard numbers, the actual, you know, market share. It's small. You know, some people say 1%, some people say 5%. But that's where the big push is. And interestingly enough, you know, Novell was a big champion of Linux on the desktop. They went out and they bought SUSE Linux, which was one of the big distributions of Linux commercial. You know, they also bought Zimian, which was, you know, a small startup that a couple guys who are currently still with Novell, Miguel Diacaza and Nat Friedman. You know, they
wasn't that working on the interface?
Yeah, yeah, they're still there, those guys. They still work for Novell. And this whole agreement with Microsoft came up recently, and it really threw a lot of people, you know, in the loop about it. You know, they really seem to be doing all the right things, Novell, up to that point.
Huh.
Yeah, and you know, and from my perspective on that, I mean, if you look at Novell is really committed. He's definitely committed to getting Linux on the desktop, particularly SUSE Linux, and as a business, they are really pretty much going to go about it any way that they can. And it almost seems like, you know, they came out and said, our customers have come to us time and again and have been concerned about, you know, possible IP infringement. Therefore, we made this agreement to alleviate those concerns by our customers, which they feel was legitimate. And while I don't agree with what they did, I can see why, you know, maybe in their mind that they did it. I only wish they would have gone about it a different way, which, you know, fighting the patent system and trying to reduce the penalties or the brokenness of the patent system instead of caving into Microsoft and going with an agreement like that. But, you know, I guess they were looking more in the short term as opposed to necessarily the long term. With getting their
customers. Those patent lawsuits are just extraordinarily expensive to defend, which makes it all the more a shame that the Patent and Trademark Office has been so lax about giving out patents. I mean, it's created a real mess in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been talk of possible patent war. You know, the couple of companies have banded together to have a portfolio of patents just in case, you know, Microsoft was to declare patent infringement against everybody. I mean, there's all sorts of crazy stories going on recently. I don't know if you guys have heard this, that supposedly Microsoft was threatening people, you know, over patents, and they were asking for money. Have you guys heard about this story?
Yeah, you're talking about where Microsoft Microsoft would go to a company who is running a Linux or open source or free software and say, hey, look, you guys are violating our patents. That software violates our intellectual property. Therefore, you should, you know, take out a license from us so we don't exercise our rights and sue you. That's what you're talking about, right, Pat?
Yep.
That the Novell deal wasn't the only one, but it was the only public one. And a lot of behind closed doors, a lot of companies are being threatened and you know, called to the carpet by Microsoft. And therefore, you know, in a hush, taking out this patent license from them to run the software.
Yeah, a lot has definitely changed since you've done your film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the last 5 or 6 years, it's definitely grown a lot. You know, one of the big things that's happened since then is Ubuntu. I don't know if you're familiar with that distro.
No,
it's really caught the imagination of a lot of people. It's gotten a lot of new people involved. Basically, it's based on Debian. And what they've done is they've optimized it for the desktop primarily.
Uh-huh.
And it really has gotten a lot of people who might not necessarily want to try Linux to try it out and like it.
How do you spell that? The name of the distribution?
Ubuntu. Ubuntu.
You can find it at, ubuntulinux.com or .org, either one of those. Ubuntu Linux. You ever hear of Mark Shuttleworth?
In South Africa.
Yes.
Because I remember him sending me some emails, I believe.
Yeah, he is the big financial backer of Ubuntu. And was he Canonical, too? He's involved with Canonical?
Yeah, that's his company, Canonical.
That's his company. And Ubuntu's done a phenomenal job of really getting out an accessible Linux distribution, along with, the Fedora project and Linspire. Has really done some work on that too, on the desktop.
Yeah, Linspire is an interesting story. They actually, when they first came out, they were called Lindos, and they actually got sued by Microsoft. And as part of the settlement, they were able to get a bunch of Microsoft codecs legally to be able to use them. And that's a big argument right now. Should Linux users use closed proprietary codecs in their systems, drivers, and such? Whether or not they should be set up by default? That's a big debate that's raging on right now. You know, on one side you got the... Go ahead.
I was going to say, where do you see Linux and open source internationally? Is it gaining more traction overseas? My impression was that particularly in China and Brazil and India that it's having extremely robust growth. I was just wondering if that's correct.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think you're going to see the adoption of Linux in a more general desktop environment faster overseas than here. I mean, you got the one laptop per child. You got the, China with its version of Linux that's being pushed out there. It's fairly big in Japan. Brazil just, 50,000 Linux desktops into their companies over there. So I think you're going to see more of
Cuba.
Yeah, Cuba. I think you're going to see a lot more of it happening overseas than in the United States in the near future.
In Germany, there was a huge rollout, right?
Right.
Wasn't there recently a really big one?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely taken off.
Is the U.S. still kind of in the geographic leadership position with Linux, or is it fairly even distributed worldwide now in terms of the development of Linux?
I think we're falling behind, honestly.
Really?
Honestly. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of, open source companies based in the United States still, especially mm-hmm. in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. But honestly, it seems that the adoption is picking up outside of the United States more. That's just my impression.
I mean, it's interesting to talk with people from other countries, particularly over there in the United Kingdom. There just seems to be a lot more, particularly with the grassroots stuff. We're from the East Coast here, and there's a smattering of stuff going on. But when we talk to people over in England, as to what the community is like over there, there seems to be a lot more participation, a lot more energy in that area than in the area that we live in. I can't speak for the West Coast because we don't live out there. But in the general talking with different people, it seems to be a lot more involvement and enthusiasm in that section of the country.
Hmm. And has it gained traction in the former, Eastern Europe, former Soviet bloc? I mean, is it? I'm just wondering these markets where Microsoft wasn't as dominant just because there's a huge lag in the adoption of PCs. If Linux kind of filled the void, or if Windows is still dominant in those markets.
That's a darn good question.
It's still dominant, but I think their grip is kind of loosening up a little bit.
Interesting.
The more I hear about...
Especially with Vista, especially.
Yeah, the more I hear with their domination there is largely due to piracy, is what pretty much the news that comes out of those countries is more of complaints of piracy of Windows or Microsoft software than anything.
Interesting.
So I the Eastern Europe, there hasn't been much that I caught my eye about what's going on with them regarding technology or the adoption of Linux. Not as much as South America and East Asia.
If I were to make a follow-up to Revolution OS, what would you propose that the story should be?
Well, that's a good question. I would have to say the whole issue of the push on the desktop, the use of proprietary codecs and drivers,
how a grassroots movement goes from being a grassroots movement to being adopted by corporate America and the struggles that evolve from that.
Definitely the whole growth of the whole thing.
Are there any particular kind of new personalities that really kind of symbolize or encapsulate that story?
There's definitely a lot more people since, when you did your movie. It's definitely more diverse.
Mark Shuttleworth, the whole, definitely.
Mark Shuttleworth, definitely. The whole KDE versus GNOME desktop, that's still raging still.
Mark
that's
Robert,
still going on.
Michael Robertson. Linspire.
Yeah.
I mean, there's still all the same big players that were in there before. Oh, man, what's the CEO of Red Hat? And who is this?
Zulik? You talking about?
Wait. Pat, Link, who's
Thiemann?
This?
Thiemann, right? Michael Thiemann?
Michael Thiemann's, he was CTO, but I think he now is like... with the open source initiative, and I think he's got like the VP of community relations. But I thought it was Matthew Zulik that was the CEO.
Yeah, Zulik is one of the big guys. Yeah. He's still there.
And is Red Hat still a prominent company, or has it been kind of pushed aside by HP, IBM, and Novell? I mean, for instance, like, formerly VA Linux, VA Software, I'm not really clear what they are now beyond the fact that they're SourceForge and Slashdot. I just don't follow them. I don't know, but it seems like they didn't go out of business in the financial sense, but they're almost out of the business. I'm not really clear, and so I'm wondering, has Red Hat?
No, not at all. They're still making a lot of money. Actually, they're still a very profitable company. What Red Hat did was originally when they came out, they were like an all use type Linux distribution. Mm-hmm. But what they've done is, in the last 6 or 7 years, they've pushed more into the enterprise as the corporate version of Linux, and they're doing very well doing that. What they've done was they stopped selling a commercial desktop version of Red Hat, and what they have is they have a community project called Fedora, which is partly run by some Red Hat employees, but it's also a community, a fairly large community behind it. And it's actually one of the more popular Linux distributions that's out there these days. Along with Ubuntu, still Debian, OpenSUSE, still very popular.
And in terms of the big companies, what are like the most prominent big companies pushing open source and Linux now?
Novell, IBM, Red Hat, of course. The Canonical with Ubuntu is pretty big. Oracle is now pretty big there's a whole thing between Oracle and Red Hat. Oracle has now released its own Linux distribution, and prior to that it decided to offer support services that undercut Red Hat's cost and support services, and there's that whole little kind of feud going on between them for getting more Linux services through themselves, as opposed to going straight through Red Hat. So that's another,
Where's Hewlett Packard in all this? Because I did a lot, Hewlett Packard, I did a lot of kind of events with Hewlett Packard once the film was out, and I was just wondering if they're still involved heavily within open source or.
Yeah, they are.
But they're not, they don't push their own version of Linux at all. They don't, for the most part, they don't offer pre-installed Linux systems.
They do on the server.
But they do provide a lot of funding for a lot of these projects, from what I hear.
So does Intel, and I believe AMD, too. We've talked with people from primarily Intel, and they do a lot of support with some open source projects.
Another big story that you could possibly talk about is the whole Linux is pretty much everywhere nowadays. I mean, TiVo is Linux. There's embedded devices, the Nokia, 778-800 internet tablets. They're like handheld devices. There's a lot of Linux-based cell phones that are out there these days. That's becoming very pervasive. It's used in everything, pretty much.
It's kind of stepping back and looking at maybe even in the bigger picture. I guess one question is, in kind of the long-term impact, on society in general, which is more important, Linux and GNU, or the concept of open source? As open source is applied to other things, and that's one of the things that kind of intrigues me, is because I guess somewhat tangentially related to this. is my concern is that is we kind of have a whole generation that have that's moved into using technology and content that no longer places a value on content. And so that creates, partly because with open source, so to speak, you get the content, in this case, the program for free, and then what you can do with the programs, how you make the money, or what someone will hire you to do with the programs, how you make the money. But the creation of the program in and of itself may or may not be a profit center. But the question is, if that concept, which I feel like has kind of migrated to other content, where does that leave us? And that's kind of one of the things that I've encountered with my film, because obviously the subject matter, and then, people naturally then want to go and post my film on Google Video and things like that, but that creates a real problem, because there's no increased functionality by someone posting my film. The problem is it just decreases the revenue, which means that another film can't be made. And I'm just wondering what's your thoughts on that?
Well, my opinion on that is I hear exactly what you're saying, and I agree with you that the content or the data or the end result of what a program creates doesn't necessarily have to be in an open or free software or free concept. I mean, there's the Creative Commons license, and we do this show and we release it under a Creative Commons license, but that doesn't necessarily mean like that you produce and put all that work and energy into producing and putting out Revolution OS, and you have a right to sell that, and it's not I don't think I have a right to copy it and illegally, procure it, which and I think a lot of people in the open source and free software community agree with that. It's not the content that we're so much interested in or calling into question as it should be open. It's more or less, the tools to maybe make some of this content or the ability to watch that content. Because if you didn't release your movie without CSS encryption protection or, if it's in different regions, I can't legally watch that movie on a machine running Linux because of
that.
That's
right.
It's in the United States. But on the other side, when you do that, you make it easier for somebody to pirate it. Therefore, I can go to Google Video and download it. And,
Go type it. Just as an exercise, go type Revolution OS in Google Video and see how many people have posted the whole film or parts of it on there. It's a huge problem for me. I mean, in one sense, in one sense, you're kind of flattered as a filmmaker. People care and watch your movie. That's great. But on the other hand, I would desperately love to make another movie. Movies cost money. It's not even if I want to donate all my labor, which I can, I have to pay my bills like other people, it's still, movies are like, it's like building a house. It's a physical thing. And I can't figure out an economics, scenario to make it plausible to make another movie when you look at the revenue challenge you have if people are going to post your movie, which, one sense, people posting your movie on Google Video, that's what they choose to do, so on and so forth. The bigger problem I actually have is with Google, because they know better, and they basically aid and abet it. And that's what's a bigger frustration, I think a bigger problem long term.
JTS, I have a question for you.
Sure.
How much would it take for you to do a sequel to Revolution OS if you had a dollar amount?
Perfectly honest, because you've got inflation and Revolution OS, I work for free and I I've never gotten paid for my labor, so to speak. So I just know what other people will spend to make real documentaries, as opposed to say a clip job where it's like MSNBC and they just go pull little segments of other interviews they've done. But if you go out and make something from scratch, forget shooting on a film. You just shoot it on professional video, you make it from scratch, and it's a real thing where you do everything from scratch. It's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. And like something of PBS quality, like a Ken Burns quality thing, is in the millions. And that's what people don't appreciate is that's material. That's like real cost. I mean, it's not like someone's getting rich buying themselves a Ferrari off of this stuff. That's just the cost of all the material and labor and insurance and all this other stuff you got to have. And I think what's deceptive is that you can go pick up a little movie camera that weighs a pound and fits in your hand, and you can go film something and get sound and image on there. And you think, well, gee, you know, it didn't take a lot to do. You should be able to go out and make a movie. You know, why should this stuff have any value? I fear that's what's happened, particularly with younger consumers of media. But I think the analogy is I could go to the sporting goods store and buy a little camping tent for under $100 and put it up in the park. And I'd be like, well, gee, I'm out of the rain. Why should it cost, $500,000 to build a four-bedroom, three-bath house? But the reality is there's a lot more that goes into it than just beyond keeping you out of the rain. And I think that's what people don't appreciate, for what's involved in making an independent film. I mean, movie making is a very expensive thing. I mean, I think movies cost too much. I mean, there's the $200 million studio extravaganza, which just blows my mind. But at the same time, you know, on the indie side, it costs a lot of money, and that's a real challenge, because particularly if you love doing it, you want to do it again and again. You know, you either have to be independently wealthy or you got to make money at some point. So,
you see, in terms of content, I don't mind paying for quality content that I really like, mm-hmm. but to be honest, the vast majority of the stuff out there is complete crap.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you bring
the vast up, majority of it.
You bring up some really, really interesting points, and there's a couple of problems there that you've posed. And, you know, I, for one, I will admit, I went out when I heard we were having you on the show, because I haven't seen Revolution OS in a while, and I heard that it was on Google Video, and I just assumed that you gave permission for it to be released. And
I've sent cease letters to Google Video following the DMCA safe harbor provisions twice already. And what Google's position is, which doesn't make any sense, really, if you think about it, is, well, you know, it's Google, and Google Video is Google's private property, but they have no control over their private property, and it's my obligation to manage their private property. Now, then, at the same time, Google has created this whole sophisticated search algorithm to sell ads based upon certain searches. Now, why they can't take that same technology and apply it to people posting, you know, infringing video content that they've been made aware of in writing, I don't know. And the reality is, they could if they wanted to. Audible Magic, based in Sunnyvale, has done a licensing deal with MySpace to do exactly what should be possible, which is you create a digital fingerprint of infringing content, and then you know you shouldn't post it up, you know, and automatically gets flagged. But Google, Google has taken, the approach that basically they're the biggest guy on the block with the most money, and they're going to do what they want to do. And their whole business model is based upon essentially making money off of other people's privacy and intellectual property without giving those other people the right to opt in or opt out or be paid for it. And that, to me, is very insidious. And I don't want to go on a rant here, but basically, if a company, and we live in a very Orwellian world these days, and in a company that's unofficial motto is don't be evil, that should be the biggest red flag right there, because essentially what they're doing is they strip away your privacy and your intellectual property, and you have no choice in the matter. Now, like a cigarette company, you got a choice whether you're going to smoke cigarettes unless you're stuck in a car with someone chain-smoking and driving across country. You know, liquor company, you know, go through all the other evil companies, so to speak, in the world. Usually there's some degree of choice involved. Google, you have no choice. And one of the things I really admired about the open source movement, I think Eric Raymond really, really articulated this well, what makes open source different from communism is you have a choice whether to participate or not. But Google, you do not have a choice, but they make billions of dollars off of taking your intellectual property and privacy.
You should give Chris DeBono a call. You know Chris. He was in the movie.
I know Chris. He was in the film.
Yeah, he works for Google nowadays.
Yeah, I know. He's like their open source community liaison. But it's a real problem, and I used to think, oh, Google, that's great. So, two guys from Stanford, alums from my university went out and created this great thing. But there's a real problem in their attitude. You know, one thing if they didn't have such an attitude about all this, but they've got the attitude. You know, I've spent a lot of time talking to intellectual property lawyers in L.A. about this. And it basically comes down to Google can bleed you dry because they're the wealthiest company in Silicon Valley, so you cannot fight against them. They win by virtue of their size. And to me, there's something really insidious about that.
You know, it's interesting to hear your points there on that, because that's almost like the exact reverse argument that you hear a lot of people saying today about, you know, content about movies and music, and that it should be more accessible, and you know, let's find easier ways to make it available and, you know, charge, you know, not necessarily free, but you hear...
I'm all for making it more readily available. The problem is I can't compete with myself if it's free.
Right. No, I hear exactly what you're saying.
I have no choice over what's being excerpted and things like that. And again, you know, I still think, you know, in a free society, there should be some degree of choice involved, and that's not what's going on here.
Now, do you, when you hear about the MPAA and RIAA and everything like that, and they're pretty big, powerful business and political entities, and, you know, they have the pendulum swinging way over one way, and then here you have Google who says, hey, we can do no evil. We don't do evil. We want to make everything accessible and be, you know, be a good company, and they're trying to, it's almost like the pendulum swinging the opposite way, and you're stuck in the middle. Being a,
that's,
you know,
exactly
an independent,
right. I'm
filmmaker.
Not a member of the MPA or the Recording Industry Association of America. You know, I'm not a studio with hundreds of millions of dollars to spend on legal staff. And so I'm just kind of stuck. And again, anyone that's an indie filmmaker is stuck in the exact same situation. You know, you do it because you love it, but, you know, you're always limited by resources. And one thing you don't have to do is go spend money tilting at windmills, i.e., you know, $100 billion corporations in Silicon Valley. You know, but I think there's a larger issue, which is, you know, and maybe this is a libertarian in me, but you know, one of the things I admired about the open source movement was that it was about decentralization. It was not about kind of a top-down, centralized, controlled, you know, organization running everything. And that's one of the things I admire, that kind of rebel libertarian ethos to it. But the concern I have with things like Google and things like that is we are losing our freedom and our privacy. And that is a real danger long term. I mean, I feel like if you went back to Red Fahrenheit 451 or you know, George Orwell's 1984, the scary thing is that's no longer science fiction. And we're not making, and I don't feel like people are making a choice to give up our freedom and privacy. And we're certainly not getting safety in return. And I don't really know what we're getting in return, but I feel like there's certain people are benefiting either in terms of power politically or benefiting financially from doing that, but most everyone else is just kind of swept up in it. And that's a real troubling thing to me, much larger than whether people pirate my movie.
Well, there's also...
I have heard...
Sorry, Link, go ahead.
Go ahead, Dan.
No, go ahead. You got...
I just have a quick question. I have heard this particular argument many times in the past, and I just, you know, as a maker of movie content, I wanted to get your opinion on it.
I'm sorry,
your
line dropped out there for a second. Could you repeat, please?
Sure. I just wanted to get your particular opinion on an argument that I have heard many times in the past, and that argument is how much money do you really feel you are losing over this pirated content, and do you feel that the people who are pirating the content would not purchase it legally anyway?
The answer is obviously that's impossible to know. The closest thing I can have a sense of is just measuring the order flow for DVD, wholesale DVD sales, which I get to see, you know, from the wholesalers. So I have a sense of what the reorders are. And I do know, since the film's been posted repeatedly on Google Video, that the reorders are off by 40%. But, you know, it's impossible. It's really impossible to quantify. You know, and the other thing is, you know, here's the question. You know, would people pay 99 cents to watch it? You know, I don't know. I mean, that's, but it's hard. You can never find that out if it's Google's always hosting it for free, and then, you know, you're basically playing this cat and mouse game with Google. Is you've got to hunt through their website, you find the offending material, you have to draft them a letter telling them, you know, where it is, and then you got to wait the days for them to take it down, and then a few weeks later someone else puts it back up, and Google's like, well, you know, it's not our responsibility, it's just our website.
So every time that somebody reposts something on Google's site, you have to go again and try and get them.
That's Google's position. Now, there's no case law that backs this up. And if you go read the safe harbor provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, you know, it's really debatable whether that's the case. But that has been Google's position. That they have once, you know, it's one thing. I totally, you know, I understand the motivation behind safe harbor, which is basically, you know, you can't expect, you know, some company with bulletin boards and email and whatnot to always know what's all the potential infringing content on their website, because then you just end up with these huge censoring filters. So I understand where that's coming from. The issue is when that internet company has been notified of infringing content, that in the future they make no effort to not host that content. Basically, their position is each distinct time, you know, it's like there can never be any penalty for them, because it's always, you know, they're not responsible for what's on their website. I mean, it's a brilliant thing. It'd be like if I were a fence or someone, you know, selling stolen goods, and each time the police came, all they did was just telling, stop doing it, and I stop for a couple of weeks, and someone else comes in and sells me something that's, you know, that's stolen, and I sell it again. And it's an amazing thing to think that's how it can operate, but that is their position.
That really makes it rough.
Yeah, it makes it rough. Yeah, really, if you don't have a full-time legal staff to sit here and draft letters and hunt through their website and whatnot.
So basically, you as the little guy is getting screwed over by the big guy.
Completely. Like, I talked to a copyright attorney that actually argued a Supreme Court case and won a Supreme Court case on the copyright issues, and we talked about this, and he said, you know what? You know, Bennett said, you probably have a really strong case, but under law, the maximum damages you could get is $150,000 under copyright law. He said, you know, Google can literally, there's no way, there's the attorney, there's no reason they would take the case on, because they could never make it, you know, it's not worth their cost financially for their time. And obviously, I can't fund tens of millions of dollars of lawsuit against Google. So by virtue of the cost of that, I automatically lose. And Google knows that's what they're doing. If you go read their interview, you know, you can go to like the Los Angeles Times and do searches on Google's legal cases. And, you know, they have about 100 lawyers on staff, and their whole position is always to prevent any copyright case from getting to trial. You know, and they bury it in paper, you know, so they can never get in front of a jury. And that basically that does is it drives up the cost, and you know, because what they don't want to get into is a situation where people are on the standard discovery process where they have to discuss how they operate technologically and what is possible and what is not possible based upon the technology they have. The reality is, you know, it's possible that they could filter out infringing video content once they've been notified. I mean, you could take a keyframe every 10 minutes, create a digital fingerprint, and have a sense of at least stuff that would be red flag. You know, it could even be as simple as if you type Revolution OS into the search, you know, box on Google Video, and they've already been notified that Revolution OS is infringing, that could at least be a red flag that, hey, maybe something's up, and maybe we need that should go to another filter, and let's look and see if that's content that we have the permission to post. And the irony is, I would be willing to license Revolution OS to Google Video and to YouTube, but the point is, if they're taking it for free, what position do I have?
Right.
Well, I definitely recommend all people to go out and purchase your movie. It's a great film.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
You know, on the whole flip side of you know fair use and everything, a lot of people are put off by the MPAA, the RIAA, you know, some of the tactics they employ going after the little guy. You know. Mm-hmm. You know, the RIAA is going, you know, suing 12-year-olds and, you know, 86-year-old grandmothers.
Well, and the irony is, and this is what kills me, is I actually, like I said earlier on, I actually believe in a robust sense of fair use. I mean, that's the weird thing we have going on. The pendulum on fair use, if you read what fair use is under I think it's the 1978 copyright law, you know, there should be more fair use than there is. I mean, you run into these situations, if you're doing it, if you're doing it kind of like in the most conservative fashion, which is what studios do, is like, for instance, if I want to show Revolution OS on the Sundance Channel, I have to have what's called errors and omissions insurance, which means that my movie's been vetted to make sure there's no infringing content in my movie, so that if someone else sues me, you know, nothing will happen, and I have to provide insurance just in case, so say, for instance, the Sundance Channel wouldn't be also a party to the lawsuit. What that means, though, is in theory, if I were making a movie, like say if I were making a dramatic movie especially, if I have even half of a poster in the background of the shot, and it's not even the emphasis of the scene, in theory, I'm supposed to go license that poster. Or, for instance, if someone were to make a fictional movie and a trailer for Revolution OS is playing on the TV in the background, in theory, they have to go negotiate a license with me. I think that's a little over the top. I mean, you know, I think that's just an incidental use. And I think, you know, the irony is fair use should be broader than it is. I mean, you know, there's a big difference between whether or not people should be able to take the whole movie and put it online and the position the studios take, which is basically there's no fair use. I mean, it's a weird world we live in right now.
We have a question in our chat here from a listener who wants to know what your opinion of what Canada does in by taxing blank media and then giving the proceeds from that tax to authors and content developers.
You know, I mean, I don't know. In general, I guess I'd have to say as much as you can tell, I'm somewhat worked up about the whole piracy issue. I'm not crazy about that idea. More taxes, more taxes. It means there's more levels of government bureaucracy monitoring everything. That means, I guess, presumably authors and artists have to then register with the government to get their tax. And then, you know, and what's happening is, you know, what's really going on, it's not people putting on a disc that's the problem. It's people putting it online and making infinite copies downloading. And I'm not really clear how the government's going to tax that, nor would I want to create a solution where then the government's going in as a government agency trying to tax that. That's a situation where I think the cure is worse than the disease.
Again, you're making the bureaucracy just bigger.
That's right.
Well, I have a question here for you, your opinion on something. You had mentioned before, brought up about, you know, there is a world of difference between what you do and somebody going out and buying a camera and grabbing their friends and shooting what they're doing in the park there and putting it up on the web.
Right.
Now, the technology to be able to do stuff, to be able to shoot and make, like, simple movies and be able to edit them has gotten a lot more accessible to people. And two questions. One, do you think that this accessibility and, you know, stuff like YouTube and Google Video where people are just, you know, putting stuff up there is going to impact at all on the larger studios or on the independent filmmakers? And two, with this technology in people's hands, it made it able for them to not only, you know, take your content and post it up there, but I see a lot of people taking content from other sources and kind of, you know, kind of like making mashups or adding their own flair to it and kind of changing the original intent of what that content might be it like a video, music video or something, or, you know, like an anime and cutting together a bunch of different scenes from an anime and putting music over it and creating their own little video. What's your opinion of that?
Well, my opinion is not the populist opinion. Let me first just work it backwards. I'm not a fan of mashups. That said, I do believe in fair use to the extent that I think it should be legally permissible for people to take a small excerpt, I'm literally, like, you know, 2-3 seconds, from a movie and include it in something else without triggering, you know, having to go out and get attorneys and insurance and all this stuff. So, you know, I do recognize that. Where I find mashups really problematic is where you take a large portion of a movie and you kind of rearrange it and then add in a little bit of your own content and things like that. I don't really have a lot of, you know, positive thoughts about that. And then in terms of user-generated content, in one sense, it's all this is great. I mean, it's, you know, I enjoyed learning to do all this. It's great that other people have the experience. There's always the chance you're going to get some, you know, some kind of fascinating, great, creative result out of it. That said, I think a lot of people, you know, and I wonder, is this because we're still early in the kind of the progression of this, or is this just kind of where we're stuck at? Because let's be honest, home video cameras have been around 25 years, basically, longer than that. My family got a home video camera, I think, in 1981. And you've been able, if you had some sense about you, to be able to edit, do rudimentary edits, since there were, you were able to put two VCRs together and connect them with a coaxial cable, which is the way I learned to do. You know, it's linear editing. So in one sense, the ability to kind of shoot something on your own and edit it together and make something has been around for, you know, since 1980 or so. You know, and now you can be more sophisticated, do better effects, you know, do nice dissolves, you have a couple of tracks of sound, so on and so forth. The problem is that for everyone, you know, film, you know, young video maker or a couple of video makers that try and really kind of do something and kind of use the technology, my perception is, looking at YouTube and Google Video, there are 24 or 36 that are basically just making the equivalent of amateur porn, which is, it's just all about voyeurism or exhibitionism. There's really nothing else to it. It's all about, you know, a couple of kids riding a skateboard and falling down, stupid human tricks, or people basically talking into the webcam in some sort of either exhibitionist or faux exhibitionist thing that other people watch for voyeuristic reasons. So, you know, and the consistent thing with all of it is there's not a lot of craft involved. Now, there are, you look, you can go out and point, put a lot of exceptions to just what I've said, but the point is, if you go look, there are like, what, 2.7 million, 2.6 million videos available in Google Video now. So, you know, my feeling is, and the thing I love about film is the craft of it, is I don't feel like there's appreciation of craft. It's about capturing the image, and it's not even really about capturing good sound. It's just kind of capturing the image and putting something together. And then what you have, the result is when you have, say, 2.6 million individual videos posted to Google Video, is it becomes like weeds versus flowers. You know, there's lots of opportunity, but there's so much dreck out there, it's hard, it can be difficult to find the good stuff. And you could say, well, you know, you look at, you know, with Google Video or YouTube, you know, what gets watched in the rankings and whatnot. But if you will notice, if you've got a screen capture shot of a cute girl in a halter top or something, you're automatically going to get a lot of hits because, you know, because the purient interest of that. But if you've gone out and tried to make something, you know, an interesting short film or something that, that's about the content and not kind of, again, the kind of the amateur porn quality of it, it's much harder for that, for the audience to find you because there's so much more stuff to wade through. So in general, you know, it's great to have the tools. I use digital video editing tools. I think it's great to have that. But, you know, there's a lot of good that comes with the bad. And long term, I don't think the quality, look, if you look at the quality of cinema or the quality of entertainment in general, has it gotten better over the past 10 years? Personally, you know, I don't think so. Is that related to everyone being able to go out with their home video camera and edit something together? I don't know, but it certainly hasn't helped. And so it's an interesting question long-term, again, about content. That's what I was mentioning about content in general. Is content getting devalued? You know, for instance, I have friends that I have, like a really good friend of mine that used to work at the LA Times until this year. And you look at what's happening with all the big newspapers, you know, and they say, well, it's, you know, partly because of the impact of the Internet and so on and so forth, and they're laying off staff. Now, it's one thing if they're laying off the, you know, the people that, you know, that run the printing presses and deliver the newspapers because fewer people are consuming the printed newspaper. The real question is when they start having to lay off reporters, because that's about content creation, and the quality of the content should be the same, especially for journalism, whether it's online or on the newspaper. But it's this weird thing. In journalism, content is shrinking the number, you know, they're shrinking the number of people involved in that. In the film business is shrinking. And in the music business, it's shrinking. All the more time, people are wanting to consume more and more content. That's a weird conundrum, and I don't know the answer, though my fear is I think a lot of this technology, the user-generated content, has devalued the creation of content.
I don't know. It seems like every other movie is a remake of an old movie these days. Same thing with TV
shows.
There's
a reason, but here's it becomes a vicious cycle. The reason for that is because the studios can't take the gamble on a long release pattern, which means a long release pattern is based, you know, upon word of mouth, people finding the film. So what their model is now is they've gone to almost a television model, which is you have to have a movie that has that people already have some sort of connection to, recognition of, and you have a huge marketing campaign. And so whether the movie's good or bad becomes immaterial. It's whether you have good images to put into the trailer, into the TV ads, and you can get people to show up the opening weekend, and you have, you know, big opening weekend, and then rapidly the ticket sales fall off, you know, literally 50% to 60% each weekend. And so you try and basically maximize your revenue before A gets pirated or before the word of mouth. And so, it's less driven in a sense by the content. It's driven by the marketing. And again, that's problematic. I mean, I have to be honest, the movies that I enjoyed the best from the past year were not the movies that had the huge opening weekend in general. They were movies that took a while to find their audience. And again, I'm not like some sort of foreign film art house aficionado. It's just, you know, it's almost inverse. If there's a huge push, you question, well, why are they having to put $100 million in marketing this movie worldwide? You know, why can't they let it find an audience? I don't know. But I agree with you.
So,
like every other thing seems like a remake, and that's very frustrating.
So the age of the blockbuster is pretty much over. Now it's the age of the small independent film.
No, actually, it's the irony. What it's totally the mainstream, the six remaining studios program are designed for, only for blockbusters. You know, that's their business model, with smaller films kind of slotted in, to fill out the schedule. But it's all about blockbusters. That's what they're trying to create, because they can't, from their point of view, it's a bigger risk to take. It's a bigger risk to gamble on a mid-sized movie that they can't go out and dump a ton of money into marketing because you can't explain the concept in one sentence than it is to go out and make Spider-Man 3. Because you're selling a pre-sold title, so on and so forth. What the supreme irony of all that is that business model works best with moviegoers under the age of, there are four quadrants in Hollywood. There's men and women under 25, men and women over 25. That business model works best with people under the age of 25. They're driven more by marketing, they're more technologically adept, and but consequently their attention's more scattered. The irony is, word of mouth, the only segment of the marketplace that is growing is over 25, more particularly, essentially baby boomers, people over 40. But they are less influenced by marketing and more influenced by word of mouth. It's dicier to make movies for them because it's harder to plan on a spreadsheet what your revenue model is going to be.
So do you think that, when you look at it, almost what you're kind of saying is that there's an overwhelming amount of devaluation of the content that is going on today.
Mm-hmm.
And
I believe that.
And do you think that we're going to see some really big changes coming down the pike because of this? I mean, one of the things...
I mean, there are a lot of... When I talk to the people I know in the film business and the classmates of mine that might work for production companies or studios, is there's a real... and I don't know, I think it may be just across the board in society, but there's a pessimism about the state of the film business. Basically, people in the film business look at what's happened to the recording industry, and they feel like, oh, we're just 3 years behind that. And what's happened to the recording industry is it's kind of, I don't want to over-exaggerate and say it's collapsing, but it's in a really bad downward spiral. And the fear in the film business is that's what's going on as well. And you're not going to make money off ringtones from the film business. I mean, at least there are a couple other ways to skin the cat with the recording industry that you won't have with the film business. And the inherent cost of making films is so much greater than the recording industry. So there's a real pessimism. Now, granted, Hollywood has gone through these transition periods before, and they take many years to work out, and sometimes you get great stuff. I mean, among kind of, film people and film historians now, the late 60s, early to mid-70s, called the New Hollywood area, is thought to be the second golden age of Hollywood, because what happened essentially is by 1967, the film industry, which is still was on the tail end of the original creators of it, had lost a sense of what the audience wanted, and they just started gambling on what people wanted, and they'd let people, they'd let essentially the baby boom generation and people close to that age group come in and just... take a big flyer and see what would come up, and you get things like Easy Rider or The Last Detail or MASH, or you go on all these great movies from that period. That came out of that transition period when they just kind of threw up their hands and said, I don't know what's going on, and they made smaller, cheaper films, and with the kind of a greater, with less central control from the studio. The question is, can we do that again? There were so fewer opportunities for entertainment then that I don't know if you can replicate that today. I don't know. But it has gone through transition periods, so I'm still hopeful that people are going to want filmed entertainment. The question is, what will we be getting in the future? You know, I don't know.
Well, in the on the music side of things, we've seen a lot of more independent publishing, and
that's right.
You know, smaller bands being able to take advantage of, or less well-known bands take advantage of the technology like MySpace and other things, and promote their music and their band that way. It's a little different with feature films and movies, because I mean you're talking like a 3 or 4 meg file as opposed to like a full movie that somebody would be able to put together. Maybe you see that independent artists like yourself being able to take advantage of the internet as a media to facilitate your product.
In theory, it's a great idea, because if it ever worked, it's great, because you could cut out the middleman. I mean, literally, you could make a movie, go put it on your website, or put it on, you know, centralized, you know, ideally you put it on your own website, and people go download directly, and you don't have all the package goods cost, and you get paid directly, and you make more money, and it requires less volume because you're making more money, and you can do more interesting things. And the idea of that is great, and I do believe digital downloading is, you know, that is the wave of the future for at least home consumption of it, once they figure out how to get it easily from your computer to your TV, you know, like what Apple's doing with their app TV and things like that. The reality, though, is I think you mentioned music, and that's a great way, again, to look at kind of where things are going. And the reality is it's pretty tough as a band to get any traction independently. There are, you know, granted, there are a few that probably make it okay living, but the reality is this is where marketing becomes such a huge issue, because that's the only way people can find the content, is if there's a lot of marketing behind the content in general, because there's so much content out there to sort through. I mean, you know, I actually sell Revolution OS through a website called cdbaby.com, which is a very, very artist-friendly website. I can't recommend them enough. I mean, they've been great. And that's exactly what it is. If you want to sell, you know, your DVDs through them, they can help you get the barcode, the UPC number. They can help you with replication if you want, so on and so forth. Set you up a web page. They take a very small fee off the top. You know, you can set your own prices. They're really great. That said, you know, they're not a lot of big, and they're a profitable operation, I believe, but they're not a lot of big bands coming out of that, because it's so hard to break into the larger consciousness. That's always been the problem. You know, if you build it, will they come? Actually, no. You got to go put up a lot of billboards so they'll know to come there, and that's the challenge. And you know, like you look at MySpace, how many hundreds of thousands of musical acts are on MySpace, and it literally is hundreds of thousands of musical acts. But the most popular stuff on MySpace in general is going to be the stuff being pushed by the big recording companies, because that's what people are aware of. And the same thing if you go look at what's all the, you know, back in the heyday of Napster, they weren't downloading random garage bands and Sino. They were downloading, you know, Eminem and things like that. You know, that's because that's what people wanted. That's the trick. And that's a conundrum, and that's, again, why the studios evolved toward this, you know, marketing above all else model. You know, a lot of it's marketing lead that makes the decision of what movies get made. And again, that's a real challenge. I mean, I love the idea that I could go out and make a movie and then put it on my website, and then people would download it and, you know, and talk about it and word of mouth, and it'd grow, and then I could, you know, it'd be great. But, you know, I know if you go out and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to make a movie, and that is an incredibly cheap movie, by the way, even if you're spending the six figures, there's no way I'll ever get that investment back.
Are you familiar with Magnitune, JTS?
Magnitune?
Magnitune.com.
No, I'm not.
It's a music store. It's an online music store that's mostly independent artists. And his model's a little different. None of the music has any DRM on it. It's available in different file formats, and he splits the money evenly with the artists. I mean, a lot of the problems with the big record companies is they bleed artists. You get these multi-platinum artists owing, you know, millions of dollars to the record company because, you know, from promotion and other things.
Right.
You know, that whole business model has to change. You know, something more on the lines of what Magnatune is doing is probably the future, you know?
Yeah. Well, check out cdbaby.com. They're very good, you know, good in that way. They're very, you know, very artist-friendly. It's a similar idea, you know, and... But, the, you know, what, there's a big difference between music, though, and film, which is the cost of creating music is a fraction of the cost of creating film content.
You got to move to Canada.
I'm enjoying my winter in Los Angeles right now. But that's kind of the challenge. So, you know, I don't have an answer for all this, you know, even if I could just wave a wand. But, you know, we're definitely in a period of flux,
Now, what are some of the other projects you're involved with, just real quick?
Well, right now, I've been writing a fiction screenplay, and got that circulating amongst friends for feedback. That's kind of, and that's what I've kind of been doing on the side. And then, you know, since doing Revolution West, I've done things like worked as a camera guy on a reality TV series, which is kind of fascinating. I've directed and produced political ads for, you know, just, you know, like state senate and state representative candidates. And right now, I'm been putting together all the corporate branding for a small startup and this is completely far afield for what my background is, but just because I happen to know the guys doing it, I'm like the creative one of the group. But it's a company that takes big industrial air compressors the size of cars and networks them all together with a central controller for maximum efficiency and constant output. And so it's kind of creating one big machine from lots of small ones. So I've been doing all like the logos and brochures and letterhead and all that stuff, so it's kind of random, but it's kind of fun.
And now that reality show you mentioned was the Joe Schmo show, right?
That's right.
That was the show where they had the one guy who thought it was a reality show, and in fact, it was just a bunch of actors pretending to be on a reality show.
A bunch of very good actors, yeah.
That was a very funny show, by the way.
It was a good show. That was a great experience. Yeah, and Kristen Wiig, who played Dr. Pat, she's now one of the regulars on Saturday Night Live.
That show's still on?
Kristen Wiig. She's one of the three women on Saturday Night Live now.
I didn't know Saturday Night Live was still on, to be honest.
It's still on, kind of limping along, but she's very good.
So. Yeah, that was a great show.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. So that was neat to do that. So I'm always trying to figure out, figure out how to put another film together. You know, that's kind of what's involved, so.
Man, that's, you brought up some really good stuff, you know, really good points tonight. That I think, you know, a lot of times people in our community don't necessarily pay attention to, which is really important. I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a great conversation. I was afraid I wouldn't be able to have enough to talk about for 15 minutes.
it was great. Like I said, the points you bring up are very challenging and are you know, like, not a lot of people think about that, I think. They're more concerned with being able to access the content than so much as the artist being fairly compensated.
Yeah, it's a challenge. So.
Yep. We got to support the artists whose content we really like. That's the key. So they can keep continuing making great content.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and speaking of that, we're you know, waiting with bated breath to hear about the follow-up to Revolution OS.
Well,
so anytime you're ready.
Well, I do appreciate that so much, and like I said, I just really appreciate the chance to come on your show and kind of chat with y'all. It's been informative for me as well.
Now, JTS, do you by chance have a website?
Revolution-OS.com.
That, okay. And somebody had asked on the IRC a little while ago whether you have a PayPal account or anything that people could send you donations or anything.
Yeah, it should be JTS Moore at Revolution. If you go to PayPal and you just put in JTS Moore at revolution-os.com.
Okay. All right. And aside from that, people should buy the DVD. It's great quality stuff.
Buy it legally. Pay for it.
Well, I appreciate that endorsement. Thank you.
definitely. And we appreciate the work you did, and hopefully we will see maybe a sequel someday. That would be great.
It'd be fun to do.
And we wish you the best of luck.
Well, thanks so much, and y'all have a great evening there on the East Coast. Stay warm.
Yeah.
Yep, take care.
Thanks, Sam.
All right.
You too. Have fun. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, listen to Alan chiming in there at the end. Yeah, bye.
Hey. Alan's still there?
You guys were doing all the good questions, so.
Honestly, I'm surprised Saturday Night Live is still on the air. I had no idea that show was still on.
Yeah, it'll never go away.
Does it still suck?
I don't know. I haven't watched it in, like, since 1982 or 3.
I guess that's a yes.
That's how much it means to me.
You know, if I'm not mistaken, I think Saturday Night Live has gotten a little breath of fresh air blown into it by them allowing to post. They actually go out and put some of the skits that they do in the more recent shows up on YouTube, and it's generated a lot of publicity and probably garnered them a little bigger audience. So
that's because they're trying to beat the people that would do it for them anyways.
Well, you know, that being said, I mean, there's some funny stuff that I've seen come out of Saturday Night Live in the recent past. Not always appropriate
really?
To talk about on the show. Yes.
That was a great interview,
I'm always a fan of a little bit more educated humor than that. The slapstick stuff doesn't really do much for me, so I've never really been a huge fan of SNL. But like Pat, I'm really surprised that it's still going. But I guess that's a testament. You know, there's been some really good comedians that come out of there.
You know what the whole thing about SNL was? They have all these great comedians on there, but they never use them properly. They're all like little bit players, and they're not that funny while they're on there. But anyway. Hey,
they're just not funny. This is it.
Yeah, is the IT Crowd still on? That was a funny show. I think.
No.
They had the first season in Britain. It was only six episodes.
It's supposed to have another season start, I thought. I haven't seen anything about it yet. I would love to see more episodes of that. It was a great show.
So, Mac Man, how you doing over there? You're a little late to the show tonight.
Who is that? You talking to Pat?
No, I said Mac Man. Apple Boy.
Yeah, you're talking to Pat.
No, I'm talking to you.
Apple Boy.
You, Mr. OSX over there.
Not me.
According to your blog post. You were walking around.
I only have a couple machines.
You were walking around your house lamenting about the... How
yeah,
wonderful.
I was. It was one of those, you know. And the funny thing is like right after that happened to me, ESR had another. He had a link moment with, you know, an epiphany with Linux himself. His epiphany was with
Red Hat there, yeah.
Fedora.
Yeah.
And my epiphany was with Arch. Actually, my epiphany was really with Linux altogether. And you know. Like I wrote on my weblog, I was kind of irritated to find that I was, you know, I've been running Linux for a long time, and I was having such trouble getting something to run on my Linux box, and, you know, you got to get up and go take a leak, and when I do that, I see my wife and my daughter happily plugging away on, you know, Mac OS X. It was, you know, yeah, it gave me sort of an epiphany. What are we doing wrong? Maybe, you know, I've been affirmative for having so much choice, and, you know, maybe that's making it a little bit too easy for there to be problems.
Oh, no.
I don't know.
I feel hell freezing over.
Yeah, I know. I don't know what the answer really is. Probably it's just... You know, it was just a bad day for me, and I ran into one of those bleeding edge dealies. You know,
you mentioned
so many other people have run into.
What was this thing that ESR said? Because I somehow missed it.
Okay, well today on
today
on my RSS feeds, yeah, I see that Eric Raymond has really given a bad name to Fedora. He dropped his long-standing support of Fedora. I guess he's been running it forever and ever and ever. And he wrote this nasty little letter because you know, he was having severe problems with that. And
no, that's how I missed it.
Distribution to Ubuntu. It's a good read. You should check it out.
Yeah, okay, I see where it is now.
One of those kind of things.
Interesting, interesting.
But no, and you know, as much as I complain about OS X and the fact that I'm a Linux guy, and I am, I do enjoy occasionally turning around and tapping at my OS X machine too. Especially now that I have that nice widescreen monitor or widescreen LCD panel on there. That's neat. Plays a mean movie.
A mean movie.
So you're happy with the 1400 by, what is it, 600? Not 1400.
1440 by 900.
By 900, yeah.
That's not bad. I thought it would take some real getting used to, but it's not bad. And the mere fact that mostly what I do on that machine is watch, you know, videos or something like that. And the widescreen format's really cool.
Yeah, I don't. I must be one of the only people in the world that does not have an LCD.
Neither do I.
I'm still stuck back with a CRT.
You guys do not know what you buy. I will never, ever go back to a CRT. I own three.
I have a
LCD
monitor,
and I'm poor. You know.
I have a monitor. It works. I'll buy an LCD when the monitor dies.
Yeah, but see, and this is what I don't understand, right?
But it's just so
like,
much clearer.
Pat, you and Dan actually program. Right? Like I program, I spend, you know, 14 hours a day staring at a monitor. And once you compare an LCD to a CRT on your eyes for the day, there's just no substitution. You know, you just can't go back to staring at a fuzzy-ass CRT with scan lines and everything else. It drives me crazy.
I like to come home with my eyes bleeding.
My eyes took a little while to get used to it because it was just so clear all of a sudden.
Yeah.
If my eyes aren't bleeding by the end of the day, that means I haven't done my job properly.
Right. Yeah, like, I mean, I have to have LCD, and I have to have it so badly that I even, you know, I took one of my own LCD monitors into work to use. So, I'm telling you, just got to do it.
I'm looking over this letter that he wrote.
It's some letter, isn't it?
Yeah.
He really
pissed the Fedora people off.
Him. You know, he's been a long-standing supporter, and I guess that he keeps having more and more problems getting his upgrades to work and stuff like that, so he just finally said screw it and switched to Ubuntu, which is, you know, hey, I'm running Ubuntu at home now too. After my problem with Arch, I flip right back to Ubuntu and everything's up and working and doing what it's supposed to. And you know, that's a sign of one hell of a good Linux distribution. No matter what anybody else says, you know, I just put it on and it worked. Not to mention, and a point that Eric makes is, when I installed Ubuntu on my system at home, like I installed it off of one CD, you know, and these other distributions come with four or five.
Right.
Foul point.
No, you only need one DVD. Come on.
Only one DVD. Only yes, one DVD. Correct. But, you know, it's a good solid disk, but granted, you know, I had to put a lot of extra stuff on there that I wanted. But when you're using the app system, you know, and for sure people, and you know, I don't always use Synaptic. I like getting down the command lines faster. But you have that app base that you can use, and you go down in there and zip, 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 you know, get the extra stuff that you want on there, and you're up and running in no time.
Exactly.
I agree. AppGet is fantastic. That's my favorite package management system in Linux, AppGet, on a command line.
Yes, indeed. Dan, put that, you did put the Davey H put the article, the ESR article on there, didn't he?
I don't know. I wasn't looking. I was...
Yes, he did.
Yeah, there it is. EnterpriseLinux.com. Oh, I was looking at the
you
one
You guys
from...
got to check that out, because that's...
I'll post the one that I'm looking at.
It's a good letter. Yeah, but he says it says it has chronic governance problems, persistent failure to maintain key repositories in a constant state, murky, poorly documented, overcomplex submission process, allowing RPM deployment to drift and stagnate. There we go, RPM hell, right? Everybody says they don't have it anymore. Eric Raymond says they do.
No, no, they still do.
Effectively abandoning the struggle for desktop market share and failure to address the problem of proprietary multimedia formats. And some other things, too.
With any attitude other than
that. Right.
He says he installed
right.
EGF.
He's
now,
right.
I tried to install EGF, and it didn't work. So I'm back to Dapper. But what are you going to do?
I don't know, because I haven't installed Ubuntu in a while.
What are you running over there, Dan?
Arch and Ubuntu.
But what do you run more often?
Well, Arch is on my workstation. Ubuntu is on my laptop. So I, you know, move between the two. Probably been using the laptop more often. Only that's because it's mobile. Mm-hmm. And I can sit over there with the family. But, at work I use Arch, so I guess I'm on Arch more often than anything. I don't know. For me, it's tough because, you know, Ubuntu, Arch, Slackware, they all have, you know, I think they're all wonderful. I can't decide which one I would want to. I don't even know if I'd want to decide which one I would run as opposed to any of the other ones. I like them all. Not a big fan of the RPM-based distributions, but that's just me.
Me either.
I don't know why.
I think you kind of get, after you've been doing this for a while, you tend to get hardened, especially as long as we have, you get hardened against the the RPM-based distributions. I had enough of them in the first, like, year or so. You know, every time I go back, they still have the same problem, so I just kind of, you know.
To a lesser degree.
I mean,
for the most part, they've improved a lot, but, yeah, you still occasionally have problems, like you mentioned, like you say.
Yeah, but for the most part, Linux has improved a lot, you know? And I'm not exactly sure whether it's, you know, the fact that the RPM-based distributions have improved or it's just Linux has improved and taken that with it, you know?
I don't know. You know, but then again, if I had a choice between running Windows OS 10 or Fedora, I think I'd be running Fedora.
Me too. Without
doubt. That's just me. Or OpenBSD. Maybe OpenBSD is good. All our BSD heads out there who love the BSD. Actually, I've been itching to run BSD on something around here. I don't know what I'm going to put it on now.
So what kind of BSD are you itching to run? OpenBSD, NetBSD?
Probably OpenBSD.
FreeBSD?
Probably OpenBSD.
Why open?
I don't know. Because I haven't tried it yet. I've done NetBSD, FreeBSD. I haven't done OpenBSD. That's why.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
So what do you guys think about this whole barrel not being included in the next release of Ubuntu by default?
Well, in all honesty, I haven't given
it... Is it political or it's like Shell where it said the stuff's not 100% stable yet?
Well, there are definitely stability issues. I really find that... I don't know. See, having run Barrel, and I really like Barrel, and overall it's been, you know, fairly stable, but you can run into problems with it on some applications that it causes some glitches. Like, for instance, if I'm running Barrel and I open up A-Term, I get, like, weird lines in it sometimes. So, but... See, that's the hard thing, because you look at it and you say, okay, who's going to be running Barrel on Ubuntu? It's probably going to be more of a technically oriented crowd. Therefore, they should be able to handle some instability issues. But then again, Ubuntu's trying to be appealing to a wider audience, but still, I don't know. I kind of like, you know, the opinion that Chris gave on the, was it Chris or Brian on the Linux Action Show?
Brian wanted it all in there by
yeah,
default.
I see his point, and I think that, you know, he has a really valid point with regards to that, that this is, you know, this is like, we have the chance to promote what Linux is capable of doing, and yet we're going to take a step backwards and not do that, and by the time it actually comes to light, we're going to look like we're playing catch-up once again, when actually we've been ahead of the curve all of this time.
I think they should make it an option. You know, some people don't like that stuff. You know, me personally, I played around with it. I turned it on for like 10, 15 minutes, and then I get bored of it, and I shut it off.
But see, that's the thing. I mean, it is kind of an option, because you can turn it on and off with the click of a button. It's really easy. And if it crashes, it just defaults back to your main window manager. So it's not like, you know, I have never had Barrel bring my whole system down or destroy my X session. It just either crashes back to GNOME, or, you know, it's not a serious glitch. I mean, I haven't had anything, you know, show-stopping happen with Barrel. But that's just me. Maybe other people have. But I've used it, you know, quite extensively. I really like some of those effects in there. I like to watch my window explode when I close it. That's a fun effect, the explosion. Have you seen that yet?
No.
No? The flames? Have you seen the flames where it burns up in a...
The flames, the transporter effect.
Yeah, to some of the new ones they have there, the explosion, the puzzle, and all that. That's pretty cool stuff. And it's not that system intensive. And my daughter loves it.
It does have a big wow factor, though. You show people who are not familiar with Linux, and they see that, and they're very, very impressed by the way the whole thing looks.
What about you there, Alan? You run try Barrel at all?
No, I've never tried it. I've seen it, but I've never tried it.
Link?
Nope. In fact, I was going to install it on my Ubuntu box here the other day when I was first installing stuff, and found out that it's not supposed to run on Dapper. So,
I don't, you know, I can't say I didn't try it on Dapper. I know I tried it on my Arch box. It did some funky things with XFCE, but no.
Well, what version of Ubuntu are you running on your laptop?
Edgy.
I should probably do that. I should probably, you know, I know it didn't want to install. Maybe it was a bad CD. I should probably just do the apt-get disk upgrade thingy.
There you go.
Over here and see what happens.
What's the worst that could happen?
Blows up.
Makes you cry.
Yep.
Makes me cry.
It's almost that time.
It's for you to
so
cry.
We're going to cry because it's almost that time.
Who's on the show next week?
Just us.
Oh, so we'll probably be playing the interview with Ari.
Yeah, we could do it. Want to do some Frapper shoutouts? We haven't done any Frapper shoutouts in a while.
Do we have any?
Oh, by the way, let me put out a quick message out real quick for those people who haven't looked at the RSS feeds or anything like that. And speaking of Ari, I'm selling my 770, my Nokia 770. If anybody's interested in purchasing it, they should contact me right away.
Like now.
Yeah. The faster the better. Alan says he just doesn't want to, so somebody else needs to buy it.
I have one. That's enough right now.
I got a question for you guys.
Now,
Two questions. Number one, have you had any problems with the RSS, the tech show feeds at all in the past week or so?
No.
Okay.
No.
I haven't either, but some people have either emailed us or posted that they've had issues with the I know last week there was one, I think, with the iTunes feed where it did, or the MP3 feed where it didn't validate, which I forgot to check for validation. But they both worked in Bashpotter, and they both work in the, the AUG feed I know worked in Amarok last week. Number two, somehow I ran Bashpotter on February 20th, which was, 2 days ago? And I got image files that came down, too, and I don't know why. Somebody's feed must have them in, and it's not ours. I got a Detect Show Slackware 1 PNG. I got Tux Jedi Sickness Fun.png and Linux Desktop Book Cover Image.png. I'm wondering where the hell that came from. And iTunes Art PNG. Wonder how that got to me. Through Bashpotter.
Been subscribing to them porno feeds again, huh, Dan?
No, I don't. It must be somebody's iTunes feed. Because I also got Escape Radio, a podcast about technology by Matthew Bischoff, image that came down, too. Weird.
Well, maybe they're all coming from him.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either.
I don't know. Somebody's RSS feed went a little crazy. Let's see what happens in the future. All right, Pat, go ahead.
Okay, let's see. We've got MXC from Johannesburg, South Africa. We've got Daniel from Townsend, Massachusetts. We've got Tom McFadden from Tupperville, Ontario, Canada. We've got Juri Repnik from Slovenia. And we've got Peter Thorin from Gothenburg, Sweden. I think that's it for today. You gonna play some music, Dan?
Yeah, I'm gonna play some music.
You're gonna play that? I don't know. What are you gonna play?
I'll play something I have over here. How do you know who got added most recently? Did they change their layout again?
No, you can see the last few people. We haven't done it in a while, so I just took the last five or six people that were on there. I'm fudging it. Faking it.
Uh-huh. How many people do we have total now? Does it say?
Don't know. Doesn't say.
Thanks a lot, Forever. This thing's been in beta forever.
Well, isn't that like a plugin or something, Forever?
I don't know. Plugin for what?
I don't know.
Look at this. There's a link Fezzedens on our Forever map. I'm going to remove them.
Get that guy off of there.
Yeah. His attitude sucks, so we're going to get rid of him. Like everybody has. Oh, what was I going to say? Oh, it seems like that we're getting a lot more people signing up on the forums these days. Because I'm seeing a heck of a lot of people, requests, and I know a lot of them are still spammers, but I went there to go handle some of the requests, which I believe it's either you or Snarkout that are really, on top of that. But I noticed that we've got a lot more people signed up.
Yes, if you're going to sign up on the forum, please fill in the information. Don't leave it blank. If you leave it blank, we're gonna delete you, pretty much. Why? Because we have better things to do than deal with spam on our bulletin board. So please, enter the information so we know you're a real person, and we'll approve you right away.
Yeah, if you want to spam somebody's forum, spam Dave Yates' new forum.
You got a forum?
Yeah, he's got a forum. Didn't you listen to the latest Linux Action Show? I mean, Linux Links? You didn't listen to a lot of Linux Links? It's a good show.
I did listen to it, but I was doing things at work at the same time, so I didn't have my full attention.
All right. I know I signed up. A lot of Linux Links. What is that? What is his URL? We'll give him a little free publicity. Dave Yates does a lot of Linux Links .com. Check it out. Right?
quality stuff. Quality
it is good stuff. Good stuff.
A lot of good stuff out there.
Oof. And we were actually on BenRev tonight, which was good.
Woo-hoo, so, BenRev.
Glad to see that that's back up and everything's going good with them. I posted this in the forum about that article about metal theft. And,
good article, man.
You know, the author of that article. Crap, let me go back over that so I can.
He was on BenRev, wasn't he?
Yeah, BenRev 186. It's on.
That was a good episode.
Yeah, CSOonline.com is the name of the magazine. Corporate Security Officer, CSO Magazine. And. Really good article on metal theft. It's on CS Online, CSOonline.com. The author is Scott Baronate. Is that his name, Baronate?
Now, what spurred that on, Dan?
What spurred what on?
The metal theft discussions. Did you, like, come home one day and someone had hacked all your telephone wires away or something?
No. I heard the author on BenRev. They were talking about... they introduced him in some of the work he was doing, and they mentioned the copper theft article the guy had written. And it really piqued my interest. You know, they kind of touched on, you know, what's the connection between metal theft, China, and meth, crystal meth. And I was like, wow, I really, you know, because I'm all about the crystal meth, of course, you know. So I came back and I was like, I'd really be interested.
Keep you off it.
Yep. Yeah, I'd be really interested in seeing this. And, you know, if there's any way that I can get more crystal meth, I need to know how to do that. So I've been climbing telephone poles since I read the article, knowing that I can make a few bucks here to support my habit. Anyway, that's all. He was on there and I heard it. And it was a really good episode of BenRev. Always good episodes there, but that one stood out for me. And when I went and read the article, it's a fairly long article, but it's really, really, really interesting.
It's crazy what people will do for money.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I'm interested in reading more from this journalist, Scott Baronate, if I have his name right. But CSO Online. Which, you know, makes me wonder, whatever happened to the Security Monkey podcast?
You know what? I don't know. I think he's getting ready to do some more stuff, but busy guy, you know?
Yeah, well, he better slow down. I can even get my entertainment on.
Yep.
Mm-mm-mm. All right, anything else for the good of the cause?
All right. Play us out.
That's it.
Okay, I'll play us out. Thank you guys for... coming on. We'll talk to you in a couple of days.
See you next week.
I want to play us out with a song called Posies from podsafe.net by Junkbox. Here we go. Thanks a lot. It's a clean song, I think, but here we go. Just in case, you might not want to play it for work, but I believe it is clean.
that you love me. Remember when you told me that you love me. Yeah, yeah. Remember when you told me that you love me. Remember when you told me that you love me. Remember when you told me that you love me. Posies and daisies and daggers and thorns. You look like an angel till I notice your horns. Posies and daisies and daggers and thorns. So full of hope, but now my empty heart mourns. I'm gonna do again, yeah. Yeah, just like heroin, yeah. I'm gonna do again, yeah. Yeah, just like heroin, yeah.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up.
Just shut up. It's over.